Humanitarians like Dr. Martin Luther King and Mahatma Gandhi inspired a number of other leaders, including my next guest. Mohamed Kishavji is a South African attorney who's helped many people in impoverished nations settle family disputes outside of a courtroom. He's also the author of a memoir about the struggle for equality in South Africa during apartheid. And tomorrow night, he'll receive the prestigious Gandhi King Akita Award for Peace from Morehouse College. Past recipients include Rosa Parks, Andrew Young, and Nelson Mandela. Mohamed Kishavji joins me in our studio. It's an honor.
Thank you very much, Liz.
I think many people don't understand. One of the things that's included on your resume is that you're an international cross-cultural family mediator. What does that mean when you're talking about family mediation?
Basically, when people have problems, family problems, the first thing they say, well, I'm going to my attorney, I'm going to my lawyer, I'll
fix it. But you're an attorney, that means more business for you.
Absolutely. That's what, ironically, many lawyers call the system which is known as alternative dispute resolution, ADR. Lawyers cynically call it alarming drop in revenue. So it's very interesting. ADR seems to be the trend today of solving problems outside the law court. Basically on the premise, why do you need an attorney who's going to charge you $300 an hour and a judge that's going to be a heavy drag on the system if you can solve your problems of how to put your little son or daughter to bed at a certain time? Yet people will dig their heels in, go to a court of law. I know many, many people who've mortgaged their homes, mortgaged their businesses because they were fighting over things they could settle totally over a cup of coffee.
But, you know, some of these family disputes seem so intractable, especially when someone has passed away and people are fighting over property that they might inherit or money they might inherit. How do you walk into this room with people who have this long history behind them, and how do you even begin that conversation?
It's called baggage. Yeah. We all have heavy, heavy baggages to carry. And it's interesting enough that when you have a mediator, the first few moments, the mediator is trying to get the two parties to become human again. And so through processes and techniques, you allow people to vent. You allow people to get over their anger and begin to see the principle for which they're actually fighting. And most times, it's a person who just wants to be heard. So there are techniques that clever mediators use, skilled mediators use, to reduce the lack of trust and increase the understanding of what it is they're trying to resolve. And eventually they are able to do this. But it takes time to allow the two people to begin to reorient their relationship.
Now, you also train other mediators, and you do that in countries all over the world. What does it require to be a good mediator? What are the skills that you need beyond patience?
Basically, listening. You've got to be very patient. You've got to be non-judgmental. And you've got to understand that people have accumulated years and years of pain through their narratives. And narratives get weaved. It's interesting that your story is never the same. By the time a problem takes place and the point at which resolution takes place, a very simple story becomes complicated.
Give me an example. What do you mean?
All right. Yeah, I may just go to my lawyer and I'm one of the spouses. I'm not talking about gender-specific things. Or he bullied me, he abused me. What may be a slight rebuke will eventually end into mental torture and psychological problems. And I think we need to get all that mist cleared up and go down to the principles. What are your needs and what are your wants? And often there is a difference between what I want and what I need. I need transport, but I want a BMW. I need a holiday with the kids. But what I want is I want to make sure we had the same thing we had before. And I think the reorientation, the reallocation of resources have to be done very practically, but very sensibly and equitably. And a mediator is sufficiently removed, though he's in control of the process, or he or she is in control of the process, not the outcome. So when two people have a problem, the mediator will say, you are going to find the solution. I'm going to help you to move towards each other.
Does that change according to the culture that you're working in? When you go and are working on mediation or training someone in another country, does culture change that discussion?
Very much so. Very much so. These, some some societies are relational. Take a family problem if you had in a Hispanic community, a family problem that you may have in a Catholic community, for example, one that you may have in India or Africa. The family is not a nuclear family. It's not two people. It's the in-laws, the uncles, the aunts, the cousins, the aunt who looked after your children when you were at work and gave them food, the teachers of the school, the employees, the employers. Everybody's involved. But you don't bring them all in. You take into consideration the concerns that they have to help the parties come to a solution that is durable and takes into consideration the matrix of concerns to make that accord stick. I think it was what Malcolm X who once said, if you're not part of the solution, you remain part of the problem. So you make everybody become part of the solution.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking Mohammad Khashoggi. He is going to win the prestigious Gandhi King Akita Award for Peace from Morehouse College. And I want to play a clip of Nelson Mandela. He stood trial in 1964 in South Africa. He and other members of the African National Congress were charged with acts of treason, trying to overthrow the apartheid government. He expected to get the death penalty. Instead, he was sentenced to life in prison. So here he is in the courtroom before the sentencing.
I have fought against white domination, and I have fought against black domination. I have cherished the idea of a democratic and free society in which all persons will live together in harmony and with equal opportunities.
You were in South Africa during all of this, and it's one of the things you write about in your memoir. I think it's surprising to some people, though, when we think about apartheid as a black and white conflict, that you're Muslim. Blacks were not the only people of color that were suffered under apartheid. What did apartheid look like for you and your family?
Oh, I remember as a little kid, you could not use the benches. You could not use the same hospital. You couldn't use an elevator. If you were downtown 1 mile from where we lived, God forbid, if you had to use the washroom, you couldn't find a washroom. We had to decide which day of the week we had to have a toothache because we couldn't go to a dentist. So these were the realities of living in a country where you were not equal because of the color of your skin. As a little boy, I wanted to become an attorney, but I could have never have got into a law school in South Africa. I went to the oldest law school in the world, in Britain. But that's where I excelled because South Africa would not give me that opening. People were not aware of the contribution made by the Asians in this whole movement. Mahatma Gandhi was produced in South Africa. India sent South Africa a young lawyer. South Africa sent them back the Mahatma in the making. And then the whole passive resistance movement, the non-violence movement that took place, people like Ahmed Kathrada, Yusuf Dadu, these are all Amina Kachalia, Zainab Aswat, these were women. Some of them were Muslim women, there were some Hindu women. They all participated in the struggle for emancipation of South Africa.
Well, you just mentioned Ahmed Kathrada, and he is in your, he actually wrote the foreword, I believe, sure, for your memoir, Into That Heaven of Freedom. He was in prison alongside Nelson Mandela in 1964. This is from a 2005 interview with NPR. They asked him how he wants the efforts by him and other African National Congress activists, how he wants those to be remembered.
We would want the coming generations not to forget where we came from, where we are, and the responsibilities they bear for the future. Basically, when we say the doors of learning shall be opened, we want them to take fullest advantage of that so that they can take their places in the new South Africa, in every sphere.
Is that happening?
To a very large extent. South Africa still has institutions, universities that have been very, very solid. I think the problem we're beginning to see is the crisis of expectations. How much can be allocated to the reconstruction of a post-conflict society? There are crises of expectations. I lived in Africa during the wind of change. I lived in Kenya for a while. I taught school in Kenya before I became an attorney. People want the basic social justice indices because they've waited too long. And I think this is happening. It happened with Mr. Kathrada in prison. They were put into Robben Island and they transformed Robben Island from a high penitentiary into a university. I mean, Mandela used to read Shakespeare. Ahmed Kathrada, I think, got 2 degrees in prison. And they actually trained others who were hardcore criminals to become graduates. So this is the transformative experience that these people went through that created the culture of forgiveness, of learning, of plurality, of inclusiveness, and a hope for the new South Africa. And I think that they have worked towards it, but I always do maintain that it will take time to create the ideal society for which Mr. Mandela spoke about. He said, I fought white racism, I fought black racism, I fought for a South Africa where people would cherish freedom, and it's an ideal I don't mind dying for. It's an ideal I've lived for. But we cannot transform society overnight. It's going to happen. It'll take its time.
So you are here in Atlanta. It happens to be on the anniversary of Dr. King's death, and you will be at Morehouse College to receive this award that is in his name, along with Gandhi's and Akita's. And I wonder how you feel about that legacy, especially of Dr. King, who is himself carrying on a legacy, and whether or not we have people still moving forward with that nonviolent conflict resolution.
I do believe we do. I mean, I think in this building itself, you have Mr. Andrew Young there, the former ambassador, who has contributed towards that road. And I think it's embedded in the culture. There are a lot of people who are that way inclined. And I think what we need to do is to bring onto the table what is part of our scriptures, what is part of our cultures, what is part of, the whole notion of alternative dispute resolution was, in its modern formulation, was formulated by Frank Sander, the American jurist at Harvard, in the Pound Conference in 1974-76. So there is that process. We need to bring it to our service in the context of today's world.
How, you're a Muslim, though, and in many cases it's religion which is the source of conflict, not the resolution of it. How do you balance the arguments over faith with your role as a mediator?
In fact, there's a lot to be done to understand the ethical principles that religions teach that could be brought to the service of mediation. If we look at religion in its rigid form, the way it's projected as a source of conflict, it will not help. But if one goes into the very principles of compassion, of tolerance, of care, of concern, of allowing the other person to be heard, this is embedded in all the faiths. And I think that if sound mediatory practices in the present contemporary world can sort of unearth the ethical principles that are taught by a faith with the contemporary principles of modern mediatory practice, that is the way forward. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission started with a reading from the Bible every morning. There are principles in the Quran that mention negotiated settlement. There are stories in the life of the Prophet. But unfortunately, if process of this nature are marred by a particular perception of the faith that unfortunately is a travesty to what the faith stands for, then the difficulties will come up. And I think it's for modern mediators to look at the ethics of any faith and see how those could be brought together in the service of a better humanity. I think it can be done. I've seen it happening in the cases that I worked for. We have a conciliation and arbitration system that works in over 25 countries of the world, including the United States. And we've done this in family conflict. We've done this in business conflict. We do it in neighborhood conflicts. And I think it is possible.
But if you look at especially the politics, and we have just a couple minutes left here, if you look at the politics of the United States, I'm sure there's people who are saying, you know, I can't resolve conflicts. I can't even speak to this other person. We're not even speaking the same language. How do you approach something in which two people are so intractable in their positions? How does that work?
Mediation, one of the cardinal principles of mediation, it only works voluntarily when two people want to make it
when they're willing.
It's willing. In family conflict, if the one spouse says, hey, I'm going to a court of law, to hell with you, there's nothing anybody can do. I think we need to project or create a culture of mediation. That's why I'm a great believer that we need to teach children at school what it means to resolve conflict. Parents have to teach children at home that if two siblings are fighting, what does it mean to say sorry? What does it mean to listen to each other? And I think that in the United States, it should not be impossible. We are grown-up people. We should get people together in the room and say, one of the cardinal principles of mediation is when one person speaks, the other one listens. And then when the other one speaks, this one listens. And by the way, you may get angry. That's normal. That's usual. But if you get angry, it's like the British say, time to break for a cup of tea. Let's have a cup of chai.
I'm always up for a cup of chai. I've been speaking with attorney Mohammad Khashoggi. Tomorrow night, he will be awarded the Gandhi King Akita Award for Peace at Morehouse College. It's an honor given out by the Martin Luther King Jr. International Chapel at Morehouse. Such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Celeste.